Hello, I'm Terry Thornton. I'm curator of education here at The Modern. It's my privilege and honor to welcome you to Tuesday evenings at The Modern. I think many of you know that this is a weekly lecture series, and we've had a wonderful season. It's been great. I have to say I've been really excited about each of the speakers. I apologize for last week. It was unavoidable, but I know some of you were interested in the election anyway, so these things happen. But we're here tonight, and actually next week is the last for this season. Jules de Balancourt, the painter featured in The Modern's first focus exhibition for the season, which is actually opening this coming weekend, is going to join us next Tuesday to talk about his work. So I suggest that you all put it on your calendar and make plans to be back here. It's always good to have the opportunity to hear directly from the artist. And such is the case this evening, as we are honored to have with us Eric Fischel, who made his reputation in the 1980s with large-scale figurative oil paintings depicting ambiguous, erotically charged scenarios set in the American suburbs, such as his painting Bad Boy, which is prominently featured in the museum's current exhibition, Urban Theater, New York Art in the 1980s. Bad Boy is also the title of a book by Eric and Michael Stone, published by Crown Publishers and Random House, which has been described as a penetrating, often searing exploration of Fischer's coming of age as an artist and his search for a fresh narrative style in the highly charged and competitive New York art world in the 1970s and 1980s. Now living in Sag Harbor with his wife, the painter April Gornick, Eric was born in New York, grew up in the suburbs of Long Island, and attended Phoenix College before transferring and receiving his BFA from the acclaimed California Institute of the Arts at a critical moment in that school's history in 1972. After teaching and establishing himself in Nova Scotia, Eric moved to New York, where in 1979 he had an important solo exhibition at the Edward Thorpe Gallery. Since that time, Eric's paintings, sculptures, drawings, and prints have been the subject of numerous solo exhibitions and major group exhibitions, including the 1983 and the 1985 Whitney Biennials. Moving to the present, Eric's exhibition, Art Fair Paintings, currently up at the Victoria Moreau Gallery in London, takes as its subject the contemporary art market, with the press release pointing out that, quote, Fischel has always been a keen observer of the relationships between people and between people and their surroundings. These paintings demonstrate the artist's acute observation of body language and the small details that reflect social relationships, particularly in the heady environment of the art fair, with its charged atmosphere of money and taste, financial and cultural capital. In addition to his memoir, there has been much written about the work of Eric Fischel, and his work is, of course, represented in prestigious private and public collections across the world, including the Metropolitan Museum of Art, the Whitney Museum of Art of American Art, the MoMA and the LA MoCA, and the Louisiana Museum of Art in Denmark. In addition to being an artist, or perhaps as an extension of, Eric has curated exhibitions including the multifaceted America Now and Here in 2011, and most recently, he curated Disturbing Innocence, a group exhibition up through January 31st at the Flag Art Foundation in New York. Eric is a fellow at both the American Academy of Arts and Letters and the American Academy of Arts and Science. We are so fortunate to have him here tonight to present The 80s. Seems so long ago. Where was I then? So would you please join me in welcoming Eric Fischel.
Thank you, Terry, and hello, Texas. It's good to be here. The title is, in a way, no joke, in that I was trying to put some images together and recall where I was in my head at the time that I was doing these. A lot of these works I haven't thought about since I did them. So this is going to be a little journey for me as well as for you. What I did do was thought I would start off trying to set a context in relationship to the show outside, which I think is a fantastic show, and I'm so happy and proud to be a part of it. But I thought I would set up a context leading up to the 80s, per se. And so I started with these works, which were transitional works for me. It was back in the mid-70s. I was educated, as Terry said, at Cal Arts, which was, I entered the school at in 1970, which was the year it opened its doors. It was the same month that Art in America declared painting dead. And I was a painter. They had a thing at the school. They didn't want to teach you anything. They wanted you to teach them. They believed that the future was something that you didn't need to learn the past in order to create the future. So no techniques or anything like that. And then the prejudice was that if you have to be a painter, you should at least be an abstract painter. So I was, and tried for quite a while. Took a while getting out of school to get rid of that prejudice. And in the mid-70s, began to explore imagery. And I didn't trust, as you can see why, I didn't trust my drawing ability. So I relied on words to carry more of the content, to set up some kind of a resonance through the words that would spin the image. It was, relatively tentative. And then I discovered this glassine paper. And the thing about the glassine paper was, first of all, it accepts oil paint very easily. You can paint something on and you can wipe it off if you screw it up, and it barely leaves a trace. And so it had a nice workability to it. But the important thing for me was that it was transparent. And what I would do would paint a television set, or I'd paint a bench, or I'd paint something else. And I would just have that on my wall in my studio, and I would just sit there and I would think, okay, so what's going on here? Is there anybody? Are they in the bathtub? Are they out of the bathtub? Are they standing? Are they walking by? Who is there? Is it, and I had this sort of matrix of a family. So it would be like, the mother, the father, the son, the daughter, the sister, the brother, all of the sort of ways of developing relationships within a family structure. So I would say to myself, where is this chair? Who's in the chair? Is somebody in the chair? Are they in front of the chair, as you can see here? Are they walking by? And as I did it, I would get another sheet of paper. I'd put it up, and I would paint what I thought I was going for. If it worked, it stayed. If it didn't work, it left. And I could continue on sort of trying to tell myself these stories. And so it progressed like that. So the important thing about this work for me was that it showed me how I think, which I didn't know until I discovered this paper, that it showed me that I think associationally, that I can start pretty much anywhere with, sort of simple set of questions and begin to develop something that either moves towards some feeling that I'm trying to express or falls short of it, and so I abandon that and go someplace else with it. And I used to think of it as like, as I go into my studio, I would think I'm doing this soap opera. And I was all excited about it as a young artist because I thought, you know, this can go on forever. It's like every day I can go in and say, so what are these people doing now? You know, and I could, you know, move things around, and it was all sort of workable that way. But what I found was as I began to show people what I was doing, they became less flexible. They being in the work became less flexible for me, that I would set them up pretty much the same way every time. And so what I realized was that I was working towards a frozen moment rather than just staying within the flux of you know, relationships and chatter and, you know, social stuff, that I was moving towards a set where the body language, the objects that surrounded the people, everything was moving towards a much more resonating kind of significance. And I show you this because this is like, at some point realizing that I was moving towards these frozen moments, I began to think, if I take myself seriously as an artist, I'm going to have to confront the problems of real painting. That that a lot of what I was doing was trying to avoid some of the criticism, not just of painting, but the whole sort of critique of you know, historical and modernist and, you know, that kind of narrative. I was trying to do something that I was so afraid of being traditional in any way that I was thinking these other drawings were a way around it. But what happened was, it, as I said, it started to say, if you want to kick it up a notch to a real challenge, you've got to confront painting. And so I did this painting. The image of this kind of boat was, I'd actually created this fictional family, and this was one of the toys that the son had, and I decided to paint it. And what surprised me about it was how vivid the thing was, that it, the light in it, that had this kind of reality to it that transcended the idea of it. It seemed like it became something else, and made me want to sort of pursue that aspect further. Say what? So part of it was that, you know, I was, you know, trying. I was working against myself, is what I was doing, and that I was working away from what I knew, or trying to disguise it in terms of fiction. And that pushed it too far away from me. One of the things that came out of that sort of paper narratives that I had been working on was the complexity emotionally, psychologically, of the family dynamic. And a lot of it, I was drawing on my own family background, terrified to make that explicit, but absolutely riveted to the complexity of family life and all of the, you know, interconnected, you know, undercurrents, et cetera, et cetera. And I became more and more compelled by the pre-adolescent boy, right on the verge of pubescence, that transitional time, which is, you know, one of the most profound moments in a male's life, and something that had been, you know, not particularly dealt with, except as, like, you know, moodiness or something like that as a kid goes through it. But it has, you know, this profound effect on our identities as males, and also our relationship to our bodies, our relationship to the world beyond that. So that isn't the reason that I started this painting. The reason I started this painting was that I was in New York at a time when there was a big transition happening, and there was a huge, very polemical debate going on, not just that the painting was dead, but that there was a thing about meaningfulness and meaninglessness that was at the basis of it. And there was a lot of artists that were very divided over those two things, and they were using highly charged imagery as a way of either coming down on the side of meaningfulness or coming down on the side of a deconstructed meaninglessness kind of thing, trying to deal with the object. And a lot of painters were working with, you know, highly inflammatory imagery, and it didn't matter how you painted it. You know, if you paint a portrait of Hitler, it doesn't matter how you do it, as long as people can see it's Hitler, it's going to make people go, ooh, Hitler, right? Pornography, the same thing. It's like, if it's pornography, it there's a frisson, there's something there, and you kind of go, ooh, pornography, taboo, et cetera, et cetera. So I thought to myself, as I'm watching my peers sort of go into those areas of, either highly charged political imagery, highly charged historical imagery, highly charged sexual imagery, I thought, I'm going to paint a dirty picture of myself. And that's how this thing started out. I'm just going to paint a dirty picture, a sensational picture. This is going to make people go, whoa. So I'm painting it. And as I'm painting it, I'm finding, going through a lot of, personal struggles trying to rationalize it to myself. I'm discovering that, in fact, this isn't a dirty picture. This is just a normal picture. This is just a normal picture in the life of a boy at a certain moment in time. The only thing that's complicated about it is that it's private, and it becomes a public moment of a private moment, a public scene of a private moment, and that's where the tension is. But that's also where the importance of it lies in terms of how to engage this thing, because what it does is it puts the viewer into the awkward position. It doesn't put the boy in the awkward position. He's in his own world discovering his own thing. But it puts us as viewers into a place of trying to figure out how we feel about this, and takes us into that world of both knowing and, all the other sort of things that surround how we uphold or how we break down, how we feel about social norms and whatnot. And this is also a major moment for me, this painting, in that I had, with earlier work, the word and scratchy image paintings and stuff, I was living in Nova Scotia, and a curator from Switzerland came through. He was doing a show on Canadian artists, and he wanted to include that work in Switzerland, which he did. Even though I told him I was an American, he said, "You're living in Canada, it's okay." This was huge for me. I was a young artist, I was teaching at a college. I was, 27 years old or something. My first European show. It was just so big. And so that happened. 2 years later, I'm in my studio painting this painting, and he comes to town and calls me up. He wants to see my new work. This is a great man. This is somebody I admire. Jean-Christophe Amon is his name, and he's like passionate about art. And he's like, he's a hand-wringer. He's a chain-smoking, hand-wringing you know, he just like gets into the art in this way that is so moving and so powerful, and he's so smart and stuff. And I had this painting that I wasn't finished with, and I had like the glassine drawings hanging up, and he comes in and his face just drops, and he's like crushed. He so clearly thought I had taken a wrong turn. And he was like devastated. So he's walking around my studio like a choo-choo train. Oh God, Eric, God, I mean, this is so wrong. You've got to stop this and, you know, get yourself together. And, you know, he's going on. And I don't know if you know this. I'm sure every artist in the crowd does. You have in your head, you have a list you don't tell anybody about, but it's a list of everything you think is wrong with your work. And it's something that if somebody comes in and criticizes you and they don't hit anything on your list, then you think, well, that's their issue. But if they come in and they hit something on your list, you go, yeah, maybe you're right. I better deal with that, right? So Jean-Christophe comes in and hits everything on my list. I mean, he, you know, because I knew that I was sort of stepping back into a much more traditional kind of representation. I was, I was dealing with a, you know, poor technique, clumsy drawing, poor anatomy, you know, all of these things that I was struggling to try to deal with and stuff. And he's like, you know, looking at the glass scene, he's going, no, the paper's too transparent, the line doesn't hold the form, you can't do that, you know. And I'm like going, I was worried about that, you know. Shit. And you know, he's looking at this and it's like, there's no room left anymore for this kind of painting. Why are you doing that? You know, it's, anyway, it was fantastic. I mean, this should happen to every young artist. You should absolutely get wiped out. Because what happened after he left, and my ears were ringing, and I was devastated. I mean, I saw my career just disappear right in front of my eyes, right? This, you know, the guy who had opened a door for a huge career possibility just slammed it shut. No longer a supporter, no, you know, whatever. No longer able to influence my career that way. And so I'm sitting there looking at this painting that I'm working on, and I'm thinking, I've got to get more contemporary. I've got to do something. So I started to imagine what. And I would say, well, I could do this. No, David Sally's doing that. I could do this. Yeah, Julian's doing that. I could do this. And everything that I was referencing as contemporary moment in terms of dealing with painting was somebody else's idea. And after exhausting all of that, I just found myself saying, I think I can make that elbow better. And I went back into the painting and ultimately finished it to make this. And you know, I tell that story because there is that moment when you take that big a risk. You just let everything go. Not because you wanted to, but because it just happened to you. And all you're left with is yourself. And yourself is not the easiest place to hang out, but it's the most important place from an artist's point of view, from an artist's reality. It's like coming down to where it's just who you are and not what everything else around you is. And so I feel a lot of different ways about this painting, but clearly it's at the heart of everything else that you'll see of my work from now on. So it gave me permission to begin to look closer at where I came from, which was both suburban, you know, sort of upper middle class, suburban environment and also from a highly dysfunctional family. And began to sort of kind of confront the conflicts, emotionally and psychological conflicts that I felt about all of that. And get more and more specific in terms of, depicting the look and of it as well as the feel of it. And at the time, this was the closest I got to, autobiography in a specific way, which is this is a funeral of my mother. And, without trying to make it be anything more to me than it, this is what it was. So, I began to look at and try to figure out a lot of the, social structures, a lot of the, hierarchies and prejudices and whatnot that were very much a part of my world at that time. And so, I did it with the ambition of wanting to explore and explode the taboos around that, to bring them into a kind of public conversation, in some way trying to find things that we could all identify with, and then from that point begin to kind of talk about or think about. And then I did this painting. Which, if you haven't seen the show, I can't imagine you haven't seen that show. Anyway, it's there. I haven't seen this painting in a very long time, so it was nice to revisit it. What I will tell you about this painting is that the only thing that I knew about it when I was staring at the blank canvas was that I wanted to paint a bowl of fruit. Which is what I did. And as I said earlier, I found that I could start pretty much anywhere and then just let it go. And where it goes is something that I'm pursuing, chasing, intuiting without knowing why or what. So this painting started out as a bowl of fruit. And of course, the next question that has to come is, where is that bowl of fruit? Well, it's got to be on a surface. It's like a table or a bureau or something, right? Okay. What else is there? And I had this photograph from a magazine of these bamboo blinds, curtains. And I thought, oh, stripes, that'd be fun. So I put in these stripes. And as I was doing that, I kind of put this kind of cool green room, color in it. I began to think about, I lived for a while in Phoenix, and, sort of thinking of these adobe houses and thinking about the heat of the noonday sun and how these adobe houses are cooler on the inside, and thinking about siestas and, okay, it's a bedroom. And then I was thinking it's post-coital. And so I put this couple in there, and in a different position than what you're seeing now is this kind of post-coital thing. And I couldn't get the guy in there. I couldn't make him feel like he was really there. And I'd learned a long time ago that if I can't paint something in there, it's because it's not in there. And so no matter how good I am at anatomy or rendering or whatever it is, there comes a thing where if you're not in there, I can't make you be there. It won't be right. It's like I'd never drawn before or something. So I took him out and I rolled her over into the position you see her now. But I kept thinking, she's not alone. So I put a little baby next to her head, a pillow. And that didn't work. So then I put this like 5-year-old kid sitting on the edge of the bed, sort of pulling one of the blinds down, kind of looking out the window. No, that didn't work. Finally, it was this kid who showed up and exactly where he was. And then the only question was, what is he doing there? And then it eventually occurred to me, oh, he's stealing. And so, you know, then the purse and the behind the back kind of thing. And that was that. So had you asked me at the beginning of the bowl of fruit where I was going to go with it, I don't know. This is probably the earliest paint. Well, no, I would say that the painting Time for Bed with a kid with a Superman pajamas had a sort of primitive sculpture in it. But I was going to say this is the first painting I did where I'm using art in the context of a narrative, which comes into play in a big way later, as Terry referenced, my art fair paintings, which are my most recent, in which I'm painting a lot of art surrounding people. This painting, you know, as it developed, I needed to paint some serious water. So I took this from Homer. Winslow Homer had painted this great painting called Gulf Stream, and that I took it from that. Sorry, Winslow. By this point in my painting, I went to southern France, which was a revelation to me. I went there and I saw people on the beaches who were naked or partially naked, who were, it wasn't that they were naked, it was that they were naked but their body language was social. That was the incredible thing for me. That was something where you could easily take that person off the beach and put them into a room of a house or something like that, and it would fit perfectly. You know, you could change somebody sort of sitting there like this and put a phone in their hand, and it would work and stuff. So it became a laboratory for me. And I had also just started to work with photography as a source material. And the transition for me from not using photographs and just trying to reconstruct reality from memory versus using the photography, you know, it was a big deal. I mean, it was, you know, it always sounds small what artists struggle with personally, but within their personal life, it's a huge, I had all kinds of prejudices against it. I thought it would, you know, sort of diminish the discovery aspect of the work and things like that. I thought it would make the characters seem a little bit more illustrative. Anyway, so I resisted it, but I was with a friend in Venice on the Lido, and there were these naked girls. They were only about this big, but I grabbed my sketchbook and I'm like trying to capture their body language, and of course they move and it's like, oh shit, and I go start again. It's like, oh God, you know. And the friend I was with said, why don't you get a camera, for God's sakes? And I'm like, no, I'm an artist. Hello. And he pulls out his Super 8 camera and goes, 8,000 frames of the naked girls I'm trying to, you know. And I thought, man, I got to get me a camera. Which I did. Now, what I found about a camera wasn't what I expected. What I found was that the camera showed me, because of the way it slices life so thinly, everybody is off balance. Everybody is in some state of motion, some shifting of weight, some slight turn, something that actually is incredibly animating. And what you need in a narrative moment is animation. You need something that feels like somebody is moving in this direction towards something, or moving away from something, or, you know, turning because of a noise they heard, or turning because somebody just entered the room, or turning because a fly just lands on their shoulder. All of those things are like, they're very small movements, and something that if I had a model in my studio, I couldn't tell them what to do, because I don't know what I'm looking for, as you could tell from my anecdotes about my other work. I need to see something that triggers a whole series of associations. So what is that? You know, so I don't know until I see it. And when I see it, it's like, okay, let's go with that. And the photograph allowed that to happen for me. It captured enough of the you know, sort of physical reality, you know, that made it easier to paint the shapes of shadows on the knuckles of a hand or something like that, that gave, you know, enough veracity that you bought it, right? As an audience, you buy into the believability. At the same time, it triggered these things that were coming, you know, unexpectedly to me, because, you know, my attempt at trying to answer the questions, why are they turning this way? Why are they bending? Why are they, you know, looking this way? And so that was a huge sort of aid in my creative process. It's funny, you know, I was also, you know, still suffering this thing of like trying to not be old-fashioned as an artist. So I thought one way that was going to separate me from Manet or Degas, or which are the sources that I was using, they were the inspiration for the work. Well, one thing that would separate me was they didn't have Walkmans back then. No one's going to mistake it, because for sure, I mean, now you look at it and you go, oh, he's got a Walkman. What is a Walkman? You know, it's outdated. But nonetheless, that was part of the thing, was like, you know, try to be contemporary. Try to show the moment now. Now, the thing about Degas so here's an example of me using photography. The thing about Degas and Manet was that Degas has this way of, first of all, organizing a picture that is so specific to where he's placing the viewer to look at something that is not necessarily the overt subject of the painting. So you'll be looking at a ballet scene, and you'll be sort of behind somebody looking through the crook in the arm of one of the ballerinas to somebody in there that's that far away. And he manages to wind you through all of that to get you to that place. That kind of manipulation of point of view I found so compelling. And it's, you know, it's highly voyeuristic, which means it's highly charged with a confrontation between self and other. And, you know, that sort of locked into, you know, am I here? Am I comfortable? Am I safe here? Am I disappearing? Am I present? All of those things come into play. And the other is that he had a very interesting hierarchical way of painting, so that as he moved farther and farther away from the thing that he wasn't looking at and getting you to focus on, he had this amazing abbreviations, these kind of codified language, where he could paint a Wedgwood vase sitting on a mantelpiece that he just wanted you to know it's a Wedgwood vase. He didn't want you to really study it beyond saying, oh, and there was Wedgwood vase in the room and whatever. How do you do that? You look at his paintings, he did it with 3 brush strokes. Absolutely dead on accurate in terms of describing something in the most abbreviated way. And it's like, God, I wish I could do that. So he had that. And then Manet had this other thing, which was that he, which took it even farther than Degas, in the sense that what Manet did was painted reality derived from photography, as well as, you know, his deep sort of knowledge of traditional painting, but from photography, where he understood that a photograph takes you immediately into the paint, into the image, without questioning its reality. When in fact, photography is entirely mechanical, artificial, et cetera, et cetera. You can look at a black and white photograph and think you're there. You know, it doesn't really exist in that manner, but you feel it does, and so you are entering it before and then working your way back out. And that is something that I wanted from my work. I wanted people to come on it and enter it immediately, and then sit there and go, I got to get out of here to see what this thing is, you know, sort of, but already have the experience anyway. So this is a photograph I took of a friend in the beach in Saint-Tropez hugging his, I don't know what, she's 2 years old, daughter. Sweet, tender moment. And I thought I would do a painting of that, or using that. And I was doing it in a way that was like, I'd already been labeled as this sort of, you know, bad boy and this psycho suburban sexual dramas. And, you know, there was all this stuff, expectation that I was always going for the underbelly of civilized life. And I thought, I bet I could paint just a sweet moment in a father-daughter's life, and people would still attach a negative interpretation to it. So I thought, here's what's sweeter than this? You know, the father hugging his little daughter, etc. Beautiful moment. Mistake I made was I took his bathing suit off. So I'm like, I'm looking at this painting as I'm painting it, and I'm thinking, I'm not convincing myself this is okay. So I painted the mother in. So she's on a chaise lounge on the other side, sunbathing or whatever. I'm thinking, you know, as I'm painting it, that'll do it, right? Because nothing's going to happen. And then I thought, boy, are you copping out here. So I took her out, because I knew nothing was happening here. But I took her out. Feeling didn't go away. So I put the gardener in. So I had the gardener over there watering these desperate-looking plants here. And, you know, sort of back to him and whatever. And I'm thinking, you know, now for sure nothing's going to happen here, you know. And again, that voice of, you're copping out here. This is not what this is about. And I took him out. I got so lost in the painting that I literally painted myself sitting at the back of the at that table, looking out and looking incredibly lost. And I thought, oh man, this is sad. So I painted me out as well, thank God. And then I painted the iced tea, and I painted the slipper. And those two objects totally completed the moment. It didn't answer my anxieties. It didn't answer my projections. But what it did was it dealt with the precariousness of the moment, and it implicated the viewer. And I put the tea between you and me, kind of thing. It's whose tea is it? Are you there? So that's your tea. So then you're involved in whatever this thing is that's going on or not going on. Or it's not. And that really, it was so surprising to me when I did it that it actually completely clarified this place, this moment, which obviously is not an answered moment, but is a real, frozen moment at a point of ultimate pregnancy in terms of meaning. Where exoticism meets tourism. These guys look like they're off the Love Boat, don't they? in the history of painting, there's the mirror. The greatest painting probably ever painted, the Velázquez's Las Meninas. It's all about the mirror, about reflection, about that kind of thing. The Arnolfini wedding, the Van Dyck painting, where the wedding couple is reflected in the convex mirror. Things like that. What a mirror does as a device, a dramatic device, is that it brings into the view that you're looking at, the directional view you're looking at, something that also is existing in the room simultaneously, but you can't see because it's behind you, right? So it enlarges your perception. That's the device of the mirror, and of course, painting itself is, often referred to as either a window or a mirror in that way, metaphorically. So I started to think that the contemporary version of it is the TV set. Because it fulfills some of the same things, which is to say that it brings into the room, into that moment, something that enlarges the scale of the moment. The difference being, and this being more specifically a contemporary condition, is that it has nothing to do with what's going on in the room. It isn't a mirror. It isn't something that if it's something that seems like it is in some way relating to the moment, it's purely coincidental. And that kind of, sort of schism that's within our lives as we, live with all of this stuff, that we can be in so many places simultaneously, and, we're in and out of our physical moment, seem like a compelling thing to explore. And so I've done many paintings that have TVs in them. The hardest thing is trying to figure out what's on the TV that sort of doesn't close the narrative down, doesn't make it too much of a cliche, or not even too much of a cliche at all, etc. This one I struggled with very much. I don't know if you can see it. It turned out to be a baseball game. When you look at paintings, you have to know that the artist is taking responsibility for everything in it. That it's not an arbitrary thing. So that you have to kind of almost forensically go into a painting, trying to see what the cues are, where they're drawing your eye, where they're deflecting your gaze, where they're, sort of seducing you back into a moment. And all of those things are highly choreographed within a painting and stuff. And I'm saying that because I'm painting this painting. It's called Master Bedroom, as you can see. And it's an odd scene. It's actually a scene that it relies heavily on people being able to go up to the painting and see, because the look on the girl's face and the mouth, her mouth, is something that changes 15 feet away to a foot away. and actually spins the moment in a much darker kind of place. But anyway, there are other things, and you know, I'm sitting there thinking, so how do we know this is the master bedroom? What are the signals of that? Is it the size of the bed is something that would say this is a parental bed, not a children's bed? Is it, you know, the fact that there's a princess telephone on the thing, although if it were pink, we'd be for sure this is the girl's room, you know, kind of. What are those signals? And I'm trying to figure that out without laying too heavily on it. Her gaze is off, not at us, but is actually off to the side. It's directional, and she's looking in the opposite way of her dog. And underneath the phone is an ashtray with a cigarette in it. And that cigarette begins to sort of create some associations with, for me anyway, with adult behavior, adult world, in a way that, you know, maybe this person that she's looking at, this direction that she's looking at, is towards the person whose cigarette that is. It didn't feel like it was her cigarette. So you bring into this moment a presence that is indicated without being explicit. It's another TV. Every now and then I revisit Bad Boy. And I've done it over my career. And it's not something that I say, well, now we're going to revisit Bad Boy. It's something that I see the effect of that moment in Bad Boy play itself out over and over again as I get older. This painting, Birthday Boy, was only a few years after Bad Boy, but I've done paintings, you know, 20 years later, that are where you know, the characters have grown up, their relationships have changed in certain ways, but there's still something that exists with that big question mark that was there at the beginning of Bad Boy that you know, it's all about desire, objects of desire, needs, wants, disappointments, fear, all of those things that are in play as we try to connect and you know, penetrate and merge with things that mean a great deal to us. Because we don't have a long time to spend on any of these paintings meditating on them, I think we'd imagine it would take somebody years sitting in front of this painting to kind of go, gee, look, those kids are the same colors as those dogs. And once you think that, you start looking at those shadows under them, you start thinking, my God, there's like dog tails there and stuff. And I'm not thinking that anyone needs to know that, but I amused myself with that. I was like looking at this thing thinking, you know, this woman, first of all, these dogs are Basenjis, and they can't bark. They're essentially mute. So, and they're, you know, they're obviously so devoted to her and, you know, her permissions or her, you know, whatever. Anyway, I kept thinking, if she leaves, do they like turn into kids? You know, these like kids experimenting with, you know, sexuality and stuff. And, you know, if she came back, they go, we're just dogs. Well, no, welcome to my mind, right? You just what can you do? Again, photography. This was a source for a painting I did, the beginning and the end. I actually thought it was kind of, I saw this guy sleeping off to the right and then these feet coming in to the other side, and I thought, did he just wrap himself around the world? Which is why it's called The Beginning and the End, partially to sort of acknowledge the silliness of that idea, but also because it's like I love the way the guy is framed between her legs. I mean, to me, it says it all. And the be-all and end-all, I guess I could have said as well. Now, here's the thing that oh my God, I'm yakking away. They said 40 minutes. I said, you're never going to get me out of here. But I will stop at some point in the near future so people could ask questions. I have tons of work, but I'm staying with the 80s. Anyway, I show you this because they're one of the sort of painting devices that I used and I've returned to over and over again is time, sort of elements of time. And I got fascinated, as in this painting, you know, with where you have something like the painting before, where you have this balcony. It could be two balconies on the same condo. It could be the same balcony, different times of day. This one as well. It's a room. It's different times of day. Is it like a motel kind of thing where different people are inhabiting the same room over different times, or the same room is because the architecture of motels is the same, they're just down the way a bit, and it's just two things happening simultaneously. Obviously, what's happening simultaneously or in any of those other time configurations is something between, you know, connection and isolation, you know, the fulfillment and emptiness, stuff like that, that become the subject of the work. I don't know what to say about this. It's like one of those things that just occurs to you, you know. Anyway. Do you guys have any questions, by the way? Why don't I do that and I can flip through a few images while we talk if you do? I see somebody there who does, yes?
So, Bad Boy.
I'm not going back to Bad Boy. All right. Go ahead.
Oh, okay.
Bad Boy.
So the expression on the woman's face bugs me and I still haven't figured it out. It looks like she's in pain, but it's not. Like, I mean, she's very comfortable sexually is how it feels like to me, and it doesn't feel like she's even noticing the boy, but yet there's an expression of what seems, feels to me as pain, but then when I look at her toenails, the only logical thing I can think of, maybe, you know, she did, you know, accidentally cut her nail or the skin, but it doesn't feel like that's the answer, so I don't know what's going on. Can you maybe... I don't know, what's your perspective?
Okay, so I'll try to answer your question, but before I do, I'll preface it with something, which is that the artist only knows half of what's going on. That is to say, I'm trying to come to a place where this thing that's formed inside me becomes externalized in a way that when you enter it, you internalize it. And there's, you know, hopefully there's enough things in there that get you going in a way to engage it so that the questions you're asking, they're your questions. You know, it doesn't matter what I was thinking in terms of the literalness of it. What they are is, it, you know, is associations that you have with the look on her face, or the, you know, you remembering a hangnail or a, you know, a cut or something like that. those kind of things are they're all fine to sort of use those as a way of interpreting something. The thing that you were actually touched on, thinking that one was canceling the other out in a way that made you wrong, was that you were saying, you know, I don't understand the look on her face. I mean, and she kind of looks like she's in pain, but she also looks like she's totally oblivious to what's going on. And you think that it has to be one or the other, when the fact is that both of those things are happening simultaneously in her. Clearly, she is oblivious to what's going on, which is to say she's oblivious to the child that she's neglecting on some major level. At the same time, she's provoking on another level. And she's seems to be unaware of the volatility and the complexity of precisely that dynamic. And so those are there. But there's also, like, you know, is the pain that she's addressing or seems to be wincing from a pain that's caused from a physical discomfort like a hangnail, or from something more existential that increases her isolation or increases her narcissism, or, you know, all those things are in play. None of them is the wrong answer. They're all ways of what I try to do is, as somebody setting up a moment, is to, you know, create signals that engage people in ways that can be conflicting, but also really are two different ways of describing a similar thing, right? You know, approaching it within that this way and that way sort of builds to an even greater meaning. So, any other questions? We got one back here.
I wondered if you would say something about things that are a little later. And I'm really talking about portraiture, which is in my mind has been very, your portraiture is very striking, and it seems to me that it's in some ways even more retrogressive than the conceptual dogma. And
is that such a word, retrogressive? I love it.
Away from that dogma, and also less narrative, not devoid of narrative, but very, it seems to me your work in that way is very penetrating, psychologically penetrating. And I just wonder, you know, is that another toolkit? Is that another set of skills? And if so, how did you get there?
Well, first of all, thank you for thinking that. That's exactly what I'm going for. I fell on the side of the argument about meaningful or meaninglessness, on the meaningful side of the art experience, and the art experience being something that is, you know, visceral and tactile and complicated and you know, psychological and emotional. All of those things were what, you know, leads to the big experience of art, and the reason to seek it out. So it's important to me, and I would hope that within all of my work there is a level of psychology, a kind of truth to the thing that makes the moment both ordinary and almost mythological. That is to say, the scale, because you can feel the archetypes of it. You can see that there are these multiple layers that run through our lives that are, you know, both quotidian on one hand like a mother, you know, watching her daughter practice, right? Or this painting I'll talk about specifically, if you allow me to. I at one point, as you could see from some of the earlier work, tried to go back to the glassine structures of layering the image so that you could feel, as an audience, these moments were construct it. So you became part of the process, awareness of the process. But this one in particular, and I think probably the most successful, was the painting panel on the left, on the right, I'm sorry, the dancer, is cantilevered out from the wall, like 10 inches or something like that, so that if you stand where the photograph is taken, the two worlds connect. And then if you move to one side or the other, they begin to break down. And to me, that sets up questions about time again. And I was so compelled by the woman sitting in the chair, which I showed you, the Bill Brandt photograph that I took her from. I was compelled by her. I was compelled because I wanted to try to figure out what she was thinking about. She had such a great interiority to her, beautiful physical, sensual body, and this look on her face that was going elsewhere. I find very compelling as a moment. And so I was trying to figure that out. And I started to, when I found the dancer, the little girl, I was thinking, it's a mother sort of patiently watching her daughter practice something the daughter's not too good at yet, is still a little stiff. I was compelled by the gesture of the daughter's hands, or this young girl's hands, because it's such a non-balletic gesture. It's another kind of physicality. And so I was thinking, and these are the questions that I ended up with, is the woman in the chair looking at that as her daughter, or looking at remembering her childhood? Is she the daughter? Is that the time shift that happens in that physical space? Or is it the daughter, as a young girl, somehow projecting a future she's resistant to? And it started to, the tension between those two started to become explicit along those lines. And I was thinking, ultimately, it seems like a moment in which this woman's past is resisting her. Whatever that past is, it seems like she's not able to really fully connect to it and is kind of isolated because of that. So, any other questions? There's a question there, yeah.
Yes. In your book, you talked about how at one point your career was going great and then all of a sudden it kind of slowed down and you weren't the it artist anymore and it really affected you. And that just shocked me because I was like, to me, each painting is, a work unto itself. It asks so many questions. And I was like, how could he question his own work?
I wasn't questioning my work.
What was happening?
I was questioning the art structure around my work. The galleries, the critics, the collectors, the museums, et cetera, et cetera. Where that there was suddenly no interest in that.
Still get a lot of criticism? Or?
Still get criticism for the work?
Yeah.
Yeah, I get, speaking to the portraits, I get a huge amount of criticism from the New York Times for having famous friends. Michael and I were talking earlier today, and he was acknowledging something that very few people have acknowledged to me, which I was so thrilled to hear, which was that he saw that, starting from the beginning until now, there's a consistency in the work, which is that I stay close to the world that I live in. And even if my circumstances change, I still deal with that world. And I'm not, held back into the past or anything. So as I became, successful, I had access to, other incredibly talented people that are, some of them are my idols, they're my friends, they're, et cetera, et cetera. So when it comes to portraiture, it's like, why not paint them? right? It's not like they're not stereotypes. They're not, you know, they're not something that, they're not cliches. They're like real people who've affected our lives in these profound ways. Why not honor that, right? And, you know, so that's one of the ways that I approach portraiture. These are all works on paper. I was just showing you some different approaches. Ma'am?
That painting of you back, it appeared to be the nude woman watching the boy, which is a bit of a switch.
Yeah, look at that, huh? And he's in his snorkeling outfit, right? He's like, which I always, you know, I don't expect other people to associate the snorkeling thing, but I do with because I, on some level, even though I paint these sort of things that look pastoral and they're, you know, a nice beach scene on a sunny day kind of thing, I'm totally fascinated by the elemental aspect of this, that space where water meets land, and that there's this deep archetypal kind of thing there. You know, the water is where we come from. It's where we left. So it has this whole birth element to it, as well as the fact that we're carried for 9 months in water and then emerge and stuff like that. And then there's this thing, our fascination with going back to that edge and playing along that edge and stuff, which is innocent and sensual and et cetera, et cetera, but also has this, you know, undercurrent. It's, we go back to the place that we came from but can no longer survive in. I love that. And so it has, and you know, within psychological terms or whatever, the water, the ocean, whatever, is the unconscious as well. And so when the boy dons the snorkel, you know, he begins to get into that place, sort of exploring that space. So, and of course, it's, you know, in my world, it's all about the girl. So, trying to figure that mystery out. Anyway, I actually have tons of slides here, so I'm not going to bore you with them. But there was a question back here. Yes, sir.
Yes, if I can remember what I was going to ask.
Okay.
It's just an observation that your work reminds me of Baron Wallace.
Oh, I'm going backwards.
Yes.
Sorry. Go ahead.
Your work reminds me of Baron Baltus, in that there's a lot of tension in the metaphors, psychological tension, but the I think the imagery is less subtle, and I was just wondering how you might respond to that.
To Baltus's imagery? Whose is less subtle?
Yours.
Really?
Yeah.
So you see a little girl bending over a deck of cards with her little underpants showing, and as subtle.
Less subtle.
Yeah, well. Yeah, no, I don't want to make fun of Baltus because I love his work, so. It's not that there. I think there are obviously differences between us, but he's an artist that he got stuck in a place, and sort of, you know, he never matured in his vision of what that relationship between him and the other is. So, you know, there comes a point where his work begins to take on an artifice that loses me. And when he works with, you know, trying to formalize, you know, just sort of deal with painting issues, I'm not as interested in his, you know, what he considers a problem. Could I ask the guy in the booth up there if he could skip to the last painting? And that way you'll see some aspect of the... So these are the most recent work. Are there other questions, by the way, while we go through this? Well, there's one. I'm sorry. What?
Are you primarily working from photography still?
I am, yeah. Not primarily, exclusively. I mean, my process is that I take a lot of photographs and I put them into Photoshop and I sort of play around with something until I get something that I want to paint, and then I go from there. And I was always worried that, well, I was taught that because my teachers were second-generation abstract expressionists, I was taught something that I actually love about painting, which is that the abstract expressionists believe that, you know, discovery and execution had to happen simultaneously on the canvas, that was the epiphany, that was the catharsis and the epiphany. What I loved about it was that I'm sorry, this painting is cropped. Anyway, what I loved about it was that it made painting seem like a, you know, heroic, you know, this incredible existential challenge of looking for something, discovering it, bam, at that moment it comes into its being. So I was afraid that going into Photoshop that I was separating discovery and execution and it was going to kill the painting. And I resisted it for a long time, but I discovered that in fact it didn't. It actually freed up the painting to do things that I wasn't able to do before. Okay. There was a question over here somewhere. Yes?
So most of the slides you showed us, the people in them seem to inhabit a very hot, as in temperature world. How do you go about choosing your tones?
How do I choose tones?
Yes.
I wish I knew how to answer that question, as a technical answer to it. But because I was never schooled in technique, I like just made everything up as I went along. So how I arrive at the tone of the work is simply by painting it and painting it and painting it until I get the thing that I'm feeling about it without having known what that was. So I don't pre-mix colors and set up a palette with a range. And so what I do is I put all my colors out on my palette. I don't actually think in color. So it's not like I could, you know, say, well, I'm going to do this and it's going to be these six colors that I'm going to work with or something like that. So I find when I paint, I just put them all out. That way when I'm mixing a flesh tone or something, I've got, you know, this pink and this vermilion and a little bit of this Naples yellow light going, and I'm doing that, and then I look over and I go, oh, I wonder what that color would do to this. Ooh, that fucked it up. Whoops. Maybe I could go with this, and, you know, da-da-da-da, and eventually kind of get to it and slap it on and go, nope, not quite. It's got to be hotter, you know, and do it that way. But I'm like the worst person to ask about techniques. I actually, which I'm sure you'll find strange, is that I start every painting differently. And I'm always surprised that they end up in the same place. Because I literally, sometimes I start off and I just smear the background with a color that doesn't have anything to do with the final thing. I'm just getting rid of white and I'm just trying to get some movement going in my body and stuff like that. Other times I get cautious and I draw out something or I paint around where I imagine the figures will ultimately be, and you know, it's every way is just a way of getting going, and then the painting is about trying to, you know, consolidate it into something else. So, just a last anecdote, maybe. I did this portrait of Chuck Close and his wife Sienna, and Chuck had seen a portrait that I did, a self-portrait that I did, sitting in front of my unfinished painting. And he said, I want that. Can you do a portrait of me sitting in front of one of my paintings? I was like, sure, great. You know. So I went over and I took a bunch of photographs. And then I walk in the door, first of all, and you know, Chuck's in his full glory in African, you know, fabric, and standing in front of, you know, one of his paintings with so much patterning in it. And I'm thinking, you asshole. That is like the meanest thing that you could have done to me, you know. And anyway, you know, and you could see even Sienna had all this patterning stuff going on. And I thought, oh, God, this is going to be a nightmare. Anyway, I took photographs, and I found the sort of, I collage everything together. So I found the right Sienna and the right Chuck and the, you know, et cetera. And I go to paint. Now, I've never actually gridded off a canvas. So I thought I could wing it. You know, just sort of eyeball it, get, you know, a sense of what those things are and stuff. And I'm doing it, and then I'm painting away, and I'm loving painting Chuck's painting. You know, he has the most eccentric sort of shapes and the most unexpected color that ultimately makes up a flesh tone or this or that. So I'm like learning stuff, and I'm having a good time. And all of a sudden, I start to realize I've got way more squares here than he does. You know, it's like, how am I going to fudge this? You know, I'm not going to go back into this painting and correct it. I'm going to just try to fake it here, you know. Maybe give Phil Glass one more crinkle in his brow than he had, or I'm going to do something, but I'm not. Anyway. Well, all right. Well, thank you very much for... I know you want to stay here all night, don't you?